Hello and welcome to Amateur Area Topics. I'm Kevin, VK6 Lima Whiskey, and in this first podcast edition for 2024, I'll be talking a little bit about Morse, Morse keys, Morse paddles, anything to do with Morse or CW. So I'm a little bit of a CW enthusiast, and that probably dates back to when I was first licensed back in the mid 70s, and the only way really to get on the air back in those days was on CW or maybe AM. I had limited funds, very simple equipment, simple transmitter, low power on 80 meters and 160 meters. So CW was the obvious choice if you wanted to be able to really work anything. DX was almost out of the question, but it's surprising what you can work with just 10 watts of CW with a simple antenna. And I started off with just a straightforward pump handle, straight key, as most people do. And that was quite adequate. I think at the time the Morse requirement in the UK to get a license was 12 words a minute. And a straight key was more than adequate for that. And in fact, you could go quite a lot faster with a bit of practice. So I used this for a while. And then a friend of mine, Peter, G4BVH, I went to his shack one day and he had an ETM, it may have been an ETM2 or an ETM3. I can't really recall. I think it was a single lever paddle. But it was an electronic key. You press one side, you get automatic dots. You press the other side, you get automatic dashes. It was like magic. Well, this is fantastic. Really need to have one of these. Anyway, I practiced on his for a while and got a little bit better. And eventually I managed to get the funds together and I bought a really cheap key. It was an EK9X. I think it was maybe made by Katsumi. Anyway, by today's standards, it was pretty rubbish. But it was all I really could afford at the time. And mechanically, it wasn't that great. It had a single lever, which was just a sprung bar. And mechanically, it wasn't great, but electrically, it was even worse, because when you used the unit for a while, the electronics would heat up and it would start to go faster and faster and faster, which would cause the problem. You're having to continually back it off to try and keep a constant speed. And also there was some variability with the ratio of the Morse. It was no longer 3:1, I'm sure. It was some other weird ratio. The only good thing about the EK9X, I suppose, is that if you could send on an EK9X at anything around 25 or 30 words a minute, then you were actually doing fairly well, and it meant you could probably send on just about anything else. And certainly the ETM range was a very nice range at the time that was produced with memory functions and some nice features, and quite solid mechanically and very stable electrically. So I think it was probably 1977. I managed to come by an ETM4C Kia, but I didn't purchase it. I was very lucky. I won it in a door prize, I think at the FOC dinner in 1977 up in London. And I've still got that Kia. I've still got that Kia in my shack. It's quite a nice unit. It's got a twin lever paddle. It's nothing extraordinary about the paddle, but it's quite stable mechanically. It's a nicely made unit electrically. It's got a memory function, which now looks a little bit antiquated compared to all the facilities we've got these days with keys and memories and computers and whatever. But this memory function allowed you to be able to program in, a CQ, a QRZ. It was quite useful with some push button controls for selecting the different messages. And I used that for many years. And every now and again, I still get that out, still use this Kia. It's a bit of fun, and it's still in perfect working order, essentially. The case looks a little bit dirty, a bit scratched, but it works very well. So I used that Kia for a long time. And then as time went on and I became more interested in contests, incidentally, it was a really popular Kia amongst contesters. You could pre-program the CQs and the QRZs and that sort of thing, and that used to save a lot of time. And it probably really was only superseded by the advent of computer logging, keyboard keying, and for contests that really took over. You still needed a paddle on hand. It wasn't like you could really operate a contest with a keyboard without having a paddle there somewhere, just in case somebody came up with something really crazy that you really couldn't deal with on a keyboard. I know there's a lot of guys these days that don't have a paddle handy, but even now with contests, even now with SO2R and having two keyboards and two radios and everything else, I've still got a couple of paddles there in a contest just in case I need to be able to send something to get the QSO done, or to explain something to somebody, or slow write down, or whatever. All of which is much quicker and easier for me to do on a paddle than it is to try and think about how I'm going to do this on a keyboard during the middle of the contest. So just getting back to the ETM4C, yeah, great unit, still got it, and really happy with its performance. And I kept that I kept using that on a QS, you know, a general QSO basis for many, many years. In fact, really, I do use a keyboard for entering the data into N1MM logo and whatever. But for general QSOing, I use a paddle. I don't use a keyboard for CW. I just tend to use the keyboard for data entry in contests, because to remain competitive in a contest, that's really what you've got to do. For many years, you know, there was a lot of, and I was included in this, you'd be operating with a paddle with a pencil stuck in between your fingers, and you'd be back and forth and whatever. But obviously that's not really viable these days in terms of serious contesting. So, but I've always retained an interest in paddles and CW, and whether it's contesting, whether it's general operating, that interest and that love of the mode is still there. So just moving on from the ETM4C, a bit later on I did acquire a Kent dual lever paddle, and that's quite a nice paddle. I've still got that here. I've used that for many years as well, and it's well engineered. They're quite a nice unit. I think they might be made in the UK. I think I actually bought this one in from the UK. And then a little bit later on, I was fortunate enough to acquire an N2 DAN paddle. These are quite a heavy unit. They've got a big brass base, quite a nice design. They've got the magnets for the tension, and the one I've got was handed down to me, and it belonged to a friend of mine. It's now Silent Key, and that's Al Slater G3 FXB. So it was his paddle back in the 80s. It was made for him by Steve, N2DAN. It's punched in with his call sign, stamped in G3 FXB, and I think underneath it's got his FOC number. So that's quite a nice thing to have in the shack. I still use that quite a lot. It's a pretty decent paddle. I think I've got that set up on one of the IC7610s for when I'm in a contest or whatever. I have that one set up, and I have another paddle that I've recently acquired, which I'm coming to. So over quite a long period of time, I've collected a few paddles. I've used a few different paddles, but never really never been a massive collector. I did catch up with somebody recently when we were in Japan, and he was a real collector of keys, and we got chatting about a few things. This is a Moto JA1GZV, and we went out for dinner with him and his wife in Tokyo back in December, and he was pretty knowledgeable about keys. He knew a lot of stuff, and then it became apparent that he had about 250 keys. So that's a real collector, and most of his keys were bug keys, single lever or Cootie type keys, a whole range of keys that he had, and pump handles, but no twin lever iambic electronic stuff. He really liked the bug key format, and that's what his collection was made up of. So one day when I get back to Japan, it would be really great to catch up with him again and maybe have a look at this collection of keys. That'd be quite fascinating. So just moving on to my latest key. The latest key here is a Bigali key from Italy, and it's a truly beautiful piece of engineering. And the story about how I came to get this key is a little bit unusual, because I hadn't really had any thoughts about trying to buy a Bigali key. I was sort of happy with the range of keys that I had here. They're all okay. I had the N2DAN, I had the Kent twin lever, I'd even had the ETM4C, and so I was pretty well covered for keys, and wasn't really thinking any more about trying to get another paddle, probably thinking about trying to get some other equipment for the station, but not necessarily another paddle. But we found ourselves, Julian and I, we were traveling last year in the Mediterranean, and we found ourselves on the island of Mallorca, We'd been travelling across Europe from Portugal across to the Balearic Islands, and we stayed on the smaller island of Menorca for 6 nights. And we have, our eventual destination after the Balearics was to get to the Greek islands. And in order to do this, we found when we were doing the planning and the flights that there's one way to do this, and it's to fly back from Menorca to the bigger island of Mallorca. And then we were able to get a flight out to the island, or we had to get a flight out to Athens and then eventually get to the island of Andros in the Greek islands. So that was our plan. So I knew at some point we would be in Mallorca for a couple of nights in June. So I contacted a couple of guys there, and we ended up catching up with a fellow called Innie, EA6EJ, who lives in the old town of Palma on Mallorca. And we had a couple of days on Mallorca. It was exceedingly hot and humid, but we had a bit of fun there. And on the first evening, we caught up with Innie for a meal. And he was a very interesting man. He'd recently retired, so we had that in common. And he was really very enthusiastic about CW, a member of FOC and CW Ops. And it was a great evening. We really enjoyed it. And we arranged to catch up the next day before Julie and I were leaving on the trip to Athens. So we caught up the following morning, and prior to that, we went to his house, or his apartment in Palma. And he's right in the middle of the old town. He's got his antennas up on the roof. It's quite a good setup, and he's got a nice station. And he said, "Well, would you like to go on the radio? Would you like to experience conditions from EA6?" And I said, "Well, that'd be great." So I got on there, and maybe for about half an hour. And he had a Bengali paddle. He had a Bengali, pretty certain it was a Bengali sculpture paddle, and it was a beautiful paddle to use. And you know, sometimes when you sit down and you're in somebody else's shack and you go on a paddle, it's not always that seamless. Sometimes, you know, you it's maybe a bit clunky, maybe the spacing's too wide, the tension's too high, and you don't really want to fiddle around with a paddle changing all the settings, because obviously the person who owns the shack may not be too happy with you once you've left, and he's got this paddle that he's got to start over again with and set all up again. So I just left it as it was. It was great. And I went on for maybe about 45 minutes or so one morning, and worked a few guys around Europe. I think I even got a spot back to VK6 from one of the locals here as well. So it was a bit of fun. And I commented at the time, the Bengali was so nice to use. He had it set up. It seemed like it was just perfect for me. It was like I'd been using it for many years. And I commented to him and to Julie that, you know, the panel was really beautiful, and really enjoyed using it. One of the nicest paddles I've ever used. The engineering on it, the look of it, everything about it was really just fantastic. So, and then we went off and had a coffee and a cake and whatever, and we said our goodbyes. But Julie, my wife, obviously remembered this. She remembered the fact that I really enjoyed using this paddle. And she remembered that, I think she asked me a few questions afterwards, and what was the name of that paddle, et cetera, et cetera. She got a bit of information together, and she made her own inquiries, and she found out where these Bengali paddles were made in Italy. And she went through a bit of a process of selecting a paddle and ordering a paddle from Italy and trying to keep this a secret from me, which she did a pretty good job of. Probably for various reasons in the end, I knew there was something going on, but I didn't quite know exactly what. And it took a little while for this to come to fruition. I mean, we got back from Europe in early July, but it was a few months later before the Bengali paddle eventually turned up. And she did pretty well, because Bengali's got quite a range of paddles to choose from. They're not it's not just one paddle. They've got a very good range, and it's a nice catalogue that they have here, showing the different models, different styles. They've got straight keys as well, anniversary keys, and all sorts of things. So the paddle that she selected for me was a good choice. She selected a Bengali signature, and it's got a chrome type base. It's like a a slightly darker titanium finish on the base and some brass top to it, and it's all very nice and shiny, red paddles. And it's every bit as good as the Bengali sculpture that I used at Innie's place in the Bell Lyrics back in June. It's a beautiful paddle to send with. If you can't send on this paddle, well, you there's no hope for you. it's very nice adjustments. It's got the magnetic tensioning as well, and really easy paddle to send on. Really nice piece of engineering, nicely engraved on the top. So very, very lucky to have this, and very grateful to my wife Julie for taking all that time and effort to try and figure out, you know, what she needed to get me, because obviously although she's spent a long time observing my amateur radio activities, it's not necessarily something that she knows all the ins and the outs of. So she did well to select the signature edition, because it's just about perfect in terms of the type of paddle that I like. It's extremely heavy. You could move this around on the desk if you were very heavy handed, but I haven't seen the need to hold this down in any way on the desk. It's got rubber feet on it, and it seems to stay pretty stable. So yeah, so my day-to-day QSOs now, I use the Bengali. All the other paddles have been relegated, so to speak. I've still got the N2 DAN on the second radio. Every now and again, I might get the ETM4C out, or the pump handle out, or the Kent gear out, just for old time's sake. But generally speaking, no, it's my day-to-day activity would be with the Bengali. I had a bit of feedback with Innie, EA6EJ in the Bell Lyrics. I told him this story. I mentioned to him that I was so impressed with his Bengali paddle, and after casually mentioning this to Julie, and Julie was there at the time, she could see I was pretty happy with it, that she managed to go through the order process. The guys in Italy were really good, really helpful, and I can't recommend the product enough, and Julie had a really good experience with them. I know she's since been in contact with them to thank them for their service and how helpful they were. It arrived in, it's very well packaged, it arrived in perfect condition. So anybody's thinking about getting a paddle, I can certainly recommend Bengali as a choice. I know there's lots of other good paddles out there as well, they're not the only ones, but I'm very, obviously very happy with this. So that's the story of how I came to come by this Bengali paddle. And no doubt it's built to last a lifetime, probably more than my lifetime, I would say. Whether or not I'll get the opportunity to hand this down to somebody in the future, I'm really not sure. But they're certainly extremely well made, and it's a nice thing to have in the shack on the radio desk. So that's the Bengali story. Other news at the moment: I've still got my two towers are both down, and I'm working on one tower. I'm working on re-engineering the beams that I had up for CQ Worldwide, which I took down. I took that tower down actually from a safety point of view just before we went off to Japan, because I wasn't too happy about having the tower up at 100 feet whilst we were away. We live up in the hills. We get some pretty high winds, and whilst I haven't had a problem with the winds in terms of the integrity of the towers, they are all guide. If we're away for 2 or 3 weeks or something, I tend to crank the tower down just for a bit of peace of mind, and I'm going to really worry about any of that. Obviously, if there was a problem whilst we were away, you know, it's difficult. I've got to try and find somebody else to sort out a problem that wouldn't be that easy to solve. So I took that tower down, and I'm re-engineering the beam that I had set up on there. I think I covered some of this in the previous podcast. But basically, for CQ Worldwide, I built a 2/2 X beam for 2015 and 10 meters. So it was two elements over two elements for each band. And the nice thing is it could be switched electrically. So, and it worked really well. I didn't end up using it in CQ Worldwide because I had a problem with the LF antennas. I had a problem with an open circuit on the 80 and 160 meter dipole. So that finished off my ideas of trying to do anything from an all band perspective. But I've since found out where the problem was, and the problem was on the feed point, and probably not such great engineering by me to terminate the cabling at that point, so I need to have a bit of a look at that. I'm using an LMR 400 coax, which has got a solid inner, and the solid inner had fractured at the feed point, so I need to look at putting some more strain relief at that point. I'm quite happy with the LMR 400. It's a fairly low loss coax. But the nice thing about it is, if you've got a lot of coaxes running up the tower, it is quite a bit more lightweight than the traditional RG213. It's a little bit more difficult to terminate in some respects, but I quite like it as a coax. I've used it on a lot of the antennas, and I've been using it for a number of years, and it's been completely indestructible. I haven't really had any problems with it at all. So I was somewhat surprised when I had this open circuit problem, and of course that occurred just a few hours before CQ Worldwide was due to start, so I ended up doing 40 meters single band. As I say, I think I covered that a little bit on the last podcast. So that tower's still down. I'm still re-engineering that. It's a slight problem at the moment with the weather. At 41 degrees centigrade yesterday, I think today's 39 degrees centigrade, so unless you really want to work first thing in the morning or maybe last thing in the evening, there's really no slot during the middle of the day. You just really can't work out there and do any serious antenna work. It's just not all that pleasant. But that's okay, there's plenty of other jobs to do in the shack. There's plenty of other things to occupy myself with, but I would like to get back to finishing the re-engineering off for that beam. So then the idea is, just on the one tower, I'll have the 160 meter antenna, the 80 meter antenna, the 40 meter X beam underneath that, and then interleaved with all of this, I will have the 2/2 for 20, the 2/2 for 15, the 2/2 for 10. And on the modeling and the practical application on the bands before we left on our trip, certainly the 2/2 seemed to work really well on all three bands, with a good front to back, good front to side. And it obviously was fairly efficient, had some good gain. I was able to work into Europe with just one watt CW on numerous occasions. So that's a good, that's on 2015 and 10 meters. That's a fairly good indication. So quite often, if I put a new antenna up and I've modeled it and I've worked it all out and I get it up there, one of the first things I'll do is I'll just try and test it with some QRP, just run 1 watt or maybe even 5 watts, but 1 watt is really a good test. And if I can work stuff with 1 watt of CW, then I know the antenna's working fairly well, and if I've got front to back and front to side, I know that it's probably doing more or less what it should do. The modeling's pretty good, but the thing with the modeling is it gives you the general idea. It puts you in the ballpark. But I have to say that in the years that I've been modeling, and I've probably modeled more than 700 antennas now, generally speaking, mostly, if it models okay, it seems to work okay, unless I've made some enormous stuff up when I've been doing the install, which it could happen. And the slightly difficult thing with this 2/2 arrangement is I've got, well, it's you know, the 2/2 phased antennas, so I've got lengths of, you know, I've got phasing harnesses and I've got control lines, and there's a lot of coax up there, there's a lot of wiring, and there's a lot to potentially go wrong. You know, there's relay switch boxes for the direction of the beams. On the upside, the nice thing is, once I get it all installed, then I've got a situation where I can, in fact, electrically rotate the antennas through 360 degrees at a flick of a switch from within the shack, and there's no rotators involved. And from a contesting point of view, that's pretty cool, because it's not, sometimes you need to be able to work something off the back of the beam in a contest, because you don't want to turn the beam because you're going to lose your pile up, all this sort of stuff. But if I can just flick around, it just makes life a bit easier from either a single operator point of view or an SO2R point of view. It just gives you a bit of an edge. Performance wise, it's probably not a great deal difference to the spider beam. The spider beam was three elements on 20, three elements on 15 and four elements on 10. And this stacked array is effectively 2/2. So you could say four elements on each band. I kind of got the impression when I was testing it out that maybe the angle of, and also the modeling does support us to an extent. The height that I've got it, the height of the top antenna is around about 24 meters. And then I've stacked it. I've stacked the different elements on the different tower sections coming down. So, the modeling seemed to indicate the angle of radiation was maybe a bit lower than the spider beam, which can be good for DX. I haven't actually at this stage, I didn't actually integrate any additional switching. Like I could, obviously I could quite easily by switching phasing harnesses in and out, I could have it so that I eliminate the bottom stack and just have the top, or eliminate the top, just have the bottom or whatever. I could do that. But I have to think about where we are. In VK6, essentially, in CQ Worldwide or any other contest for that matter, just about every QSO is a DX QSO. It's a long distance QSO. Even if I work a JA, it's then 8,000 kilometers or something other. So even if I work a ZL, it's 5,000 kilometers. There's nothing much new at hand in VK6. It's not like I've got a lot of short skip propagation. I've got to change the stack so I get a higher angle of propagation. VK2, VK3, you know, it's 3,000 kilometers. So nothing's close at hand. It probably doesn't matter that much in VK6. If you had this antenna maybe in Europe and you wanted to optimize it so that you could work the short skip stuff a little bit easier, maybe there's a case for having some relays in the phasing harnesses and be able to switch around. And I could still do that for a bit of fun, a bit of experimentation, just to see how it works. So I'm looking forward to getting that antenna project finished. I'm probably not going to get a great deal of progress until this weather cools off a bit. And for that to happen, I'm probably looking at April, May before we start to see some significantly lower temperatures. We may have a bit of a cooling trend next week, I think, but we're still talking about 30 degrees or something. But it's better than 41. So the other tower, I still have a problem with. I had a winch cable failure on the second tower, and I've got quite a bit of work to do with that. And that can only really be done when it's winter, because I need to be outside welding, and I can't do that at the moment. I've got a couple of the sections in the workshop, which I need to fix up. So eventually I'll get them one fixed up. I'll be back to two towers. In the meantime, I will try and get one tower set up for the six bands. I've been having a bit of fun using my multiband antennas. These are antennas that I use for receive when I'm doing SO2R or 2B SIQ. And I've got these antennas around about 120, 130 meters away from the transmit antennas. So, but they're not bad antennas. They're essentially the multiband antennas, doublet style, fed with some open wire line, 75 ohm coax, that sort of thing. Got one particular antenna that covers six bands with quite a low SWR. I even found the other day that it loads up pretty well on 6 meters with a low SWR. Yet to work anybody on 6 meters, but I will keep taking a look. I can hear the local beacon, so it is obviously working, but it's certainly got a low SWR. Not that that means anything. You can have a low SWR and the antenna can be completely useless, but it's not a bad sign. So technically it could do seven bands, that one particular antenna. That's just suspended from a tree. I think the top's around about, top's at around about 22 meters. Bottom's probably at around about 10 meters or so, bit of a sloper. It works really well. Again, I've worked into Europe with that on 2015 and 10, which is 5 watts of CW. And that's a bit of fun. Those sorts of multiband antennas are quite useful for transmit if you haven't got anything else. And it keeps me on the bands, keeps a bit of interest going while I'm still working on these tower-based antennas. It's not really an antenna that I can use for transmit in a contest, but for receive in a contest, they're very useful antennas. So I've got another antenna that runs at right angles to that, which is also a multiband off-center fed type antenna. So I might be just changing that format around a little bit. But the important thing is those antennas are a long way from the transmit antennas. That helps me with my SO2R, helps me with the receiver bandpass filters I've got, that sort of thing. So there's a few projects going on. Always seems to be something going on. There's quite a bit of stuff I post these days on Instagram. So you can go on Instagram, you can find me on there, VK6LW on Instagram. There's quite a lot of posts of equipment, CW, contests, conditions, all the stuff that I'm kind of interested in. And largely, that's it. There's not much other stuff on there, there's not much travel stuff. There's not a great deal of other personal stuff. It's mainly just all about radio and equipment. And it's been quite interesting. There's quite a few people on Instagram posting like-minded stuff, and a lot of parts on the air, summit on the air, that sort of thing, activity on Instagram. So worth checking out, VK6LW, if you get a moment, take a look. Okay, so I think that's about the wrap up for this particular podcast, and I will say 73s, and good luck for 2024, and enjoy the bank editions. The ATF bank edition has been excellent, so pretty good fun on 2015 and 10 at the moment. 73s, take care, and we'll be in touch soon with a new podcast.